From Toronto, Canada, home of igloos, polar bears, and flying hockey pucks, this is Inside Movies and TV.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. We are tonight's entertainment.
Well, hello there, everyone. Welcome to Inside Movies and TV, show number 66. Thank you once again for joining us. My name is Jamie Hosking, and with us today is my co-host, Aaron Shaw, sitting across from me at the table. Hello, Aaron.
Hi, Jamie.
How are you today?
I'm good. Summer's finally here.
Summer's finally here, yep. We've been neck deep in going to see movies and getting involved in all that summer has to offer finally here in Toronto with some great weather. And joining us today once again is our special guest, Dennis. How's it going, Dennis?
Great, Jamie. How you doing, Aaron?
I'm fine.
You staying cool?
Yes.
Air conditioning at the movies. Hurrah.
Yeah.
Yeah, one of the many benefits of the summer movie season. We've got a lot of stories this week, some television, some movie news, even some video news, if time permits. Lots going on, including the opening of one of the more anticipated, what people were thinking will be a sleeper hit of the summer, District 9. We're wrapping up kind of the summer movie season as August comes to a close here. We're recording this on August 16th. And this tends to be the time of the summer movie season where you're getting a few of the smaller movies, such as Julie and Julia, the Meryl Streep movie about Julia Child, as well as some smaller comedies and that sort of thing, some family movies. And we've got one more, I guess, fairly big movie, if you could consider it, Inglourious Basterds.
Anticipated movie.
Quentin Tarantino movie that's coming out next week. And then we get into September, which is not a time of year I look forward to at the theater.
And yet you want to see Gamer, but you don't want to see that movie with Paul Bettany that we saw the trailer for that's coming out in January. Same thing.
Are you calling me out on something? Is that what's happening at the beginning of this?
I'm dropping the gloves.
I don't want to see a Paul Bettany movie. How many here could blame me for not wanting to see a Paul Bettany?
I believe you were completely intrigued by the whole thing. It looked really awesome.
And you said
it comes out January 22nd. I'm not going to see it.
I never said I wasn't going to see it. I just said, oh, it's coming out in January. It's never a good sign.
You didn't say that about Gamer, though.
Anything that comes out, well, you know, that's not a good sign. It's kind of one of those movies that would appeal to the little boy in me. I don't imagine it's going to get fantastic reviews. I don't care who's in it.
I don't even know.
Directors, they don't even look like real directors for this particular movie, Gamer.
Oh, for Gamer, yeah. They don't have a name.
Gerard Butler. Yeah, it's two last names with a forward slash between them. They're like, I don't even know what that was about, so... Yeah, I mean, what I'm trying to get at, and you know, many movie buffs do realize this, is that movies that come out in September and January typically aren't that great. I know there have been various articles printed about the whole idea that, you know, if they were good enough, they would be out in July and August or November and December. What about American Beauty? That it was probably the exception to the rule. That's one. And for every one... There's probably a dozen that prove the rule. Yeah. Just like the rule where you see...
From the words of Jamie.
Yeah, Hosting. Well, no, it's. I'm certainly not coming up with some sort of new theory.
Deep.
I'm not coming up with a new theory at all. This crystallized for me years ago when I saw a movie on Labor Day weekend called Knock Off, starring Jean-Claude Van Damme. And the villain was Paul Sorvino, for Christ's sake. Paul Sorvino. You remember Paul Sorvino? Used to be a good actor. You know, used to get quality roles. He got his start on Law and Order, for God's sake. He was one of the first actors to play one of the cops on Law and Order.
Well, I remember the movie and I know what you're talking about. Actors can choose what they want. They have as many flops as they have successes. I mean, just look at Ben Kingsley. He was in Thunderbirds, for crying out loud. And he's in Shutter Island and he was Gandhi. And there was another movie. He was just in a movie recently that's coming out... Oh, and he was, sorry, that's in 50 Dead Men Walking.
Well, Aaron, you remind me one of my favorite memories was... at the Genie Awards. I went one year, and I was in line at the buffet, And behind me, Mary Steenburgen was there. She was filming, I think it was One Magic Christmas, I think was the title. And her husband was there, Malcolm McDowell, with her, as well as Roddy McDowell. And they were talking, and you're talking about actors slumming. And here was Malcolm McDowell. I heard him, overheard him saying to his cohorts, "Yeah, Caligula, what a ripoff that was."
Well, I don't know. Believe me, nobody is happier than I am when a movie proves to be the exception to the rule. One of the other rules that was, we won't get into it. I promise you we won't. But, and the reviews have not been good. I'll be the first to admit it. But a movie that will open without screening for critics.
Oh, no, don't start with me.
I'm not going to start, but what I'm saying is there are far the percentages is drastically against a movie that doesn't open for critics. That means the studio has got no faith in it, and they want to nab as much box office dollars as they can that first weekend before the movie tanks. I do believe that G.I. Joe is a mild exception to that rule, but the vast majority of movies that open without critical screenings, and there have been articles, I think, in Entertainment Weekly and all about this, with a list of all the horrible, horrible movies that open without a preview screening.
I had low expectations for G.I. Joe, and I came out with lower expectations.
Well, speaking of September for movies, though, we can't forget that it's the month of film festivals, especially across Canada. We've got Toronto and Halifax, and then coming up in late September, early October is Vancouver. And the thing about September film festivals, especially in Toronto, is the chance to see movies that you might not see maybe even for a year later, depending on their agreements for distribution that are usually signed at the festival. What I'm thinking for example, is the movie Good, which starred Viggo Mortensen, which Jamie saw with me last year. I don't think Aaron's seen it, but it hasn't been released yet, and it was quite a good movie. And then there's the other movie, It Might Get Loud, which is only now just starting to get a release, a documentary about rock guitarists starring Jimmy Page, Jack White, and The Edge from U2, which was really exciting in Toronto because all three gentlemen attended the premiere. And that's something that in September, if you're looking at for film buffs, there's the festival, but it's expensive. And the person who usually likes to go, the average person, doesn't, unless you're willing to pay money and stand in line, and probably in the rain, for that privilege, don't get to see. But it's one thing to look forward to.
Okay, let's get going to the stories. I know you have a thought, but it's just because I have something that I wanted to talk about later, if time permits.
Right.
And I have a feeling
absolutely
it's going to be a long discussion.
To be continued, absolutely. All right, so let's get into the stories. We've got lots of great stuff to talk about. The first thing that, of course, we'll talk about is the weekend box office and the sci-fi action thriller District 9 about a colony of aliens stranded in South Africa landed atop the North American box office with an estimated $37 million in its first weekend. That's according to Sony Pictures. The faux documentary is produced by Peter Jackson, of course, the Oscar-winning filmmaker behind the Lord of the Rings trilogy. It was buoyed by largely favorable reviews and a promotional blitz at the recent Comic-Con convention that stoked pre-release buzz. The film was directed and co-written by South African native Neil Blomkamp, who is a protege of Peter Jackson's, and he's making his feature film directorial debut after a career of doing commercials. One thing you want to check out if you're particularly interested is he has a short film online on YouTube that he used as the basis for District 9. It's called Alive in Joburg, or Alive in Joburg, depending on how you want to say it. One thing that isn't mentioned here, but I'll quickly point out, is that Mr. Blomkamp was originally contracted by Peter Jackson to direct a movie version of the intensely popular video game Halo. And when the budget got crazy out of control, the studios involved, I believe it might have been Warner Brothers and or Paramount, pulled the plug, thinking that the budget was going to get crazy out of control. And District 9, in a lot of ways, is a statement to say, look, we can make a science fiction action movie for a very small amount of money, and it looks like we spent a lot more. This movie in particular, $30 million budget, it earned $37 million its opening weekend just domestically. Made its budget back. Boom. Right there. One weekend. The effects are incredible. And when you consider that G.I. Joe has a budget of, what, it was $175 million? Mm-hmm. And you don't notice any difference in quality. They did shoot in the actual slums in Johannesburg. And another thing, too, is that, you know, you take a movie like District 9, and its budget's $5 million less than The Hangover, which had no special effects, really. Continuing on with the box office, last week's number one film in the U.S. and Canada, G.I. Joe, The Rise of Cobra, fell to number two this weekend with a Friday through Sunday estimate gross of $22.5 million. Still pretty respectable.
Universal Pictures has signed Bryan Singer to produce and direct a future version of the sci-fi TV series. Bryan Singer's career got started, of course, with the award-winning Usual Suspects, but most fans know him as the director of the first two X-Men movies and the 2006 disappointment, Superman Returns. I threw that in there. Singer, of course, he had been in developing a new Battlestar Galactica TV series, but reportedly plans scrapped after the events of September 11th, 2001, when it was felt a TV show about a city being attacked and destroyed wouldn't be well received. That didn't stop 24. A few years later, Ronald Moore produced his own Battlestar Galactica relaunch, and the show just went off the air after 73 episodes, and just a huge fan base. Great, great series.
And not nearly enough awards.
Not nearly enough awards. It is unknown if Ronald Moore will be involved at all with this new Galactica movie, and it's being produced by Glenn Larson, who is the creator of the original 1970s show. Since Singer's approach is being called a complete reimagination, which would be a reimagination of a reimagination, it's expected that there will be no direct ties between Moore's recent series and this new movie, which will relaunch the concept for a second time, as I just said. There's no word yet as to who will be writing the script for the new Battlestar Galactica either. The hunch is probably that it's expects Singer's Galactica to have a lighter tone than Ronald Moore's rather dire and dark TV series.
This could be a horrible move. When the TV series was first announced and launched, most people who were familiar with it thought, is this going to be a good idea? The show wasn't that great. The show was, to be honest, a direct ripoff of Star Wars. Came out in the late 70s, right after Star Wars became a huge surprise hit in box offices, and everybody, both in film and television, were looking for ways to borrow, rip off, capitalize on the popularity of science fiction and fantasy that was happening right then. And in fact, some of the special effects people who worked with George Lucas and had since moved on worked on the effects for Galactica. And even some of the designs for the Cylons were designs that were created by people who did concept artwork and that sort of thing. And, you know, you look at the Cylons, especially the designs from the TV show, they look like chrome Darth Vaders. Mm-hmm. So to do a relaunch of this again after it was so successfully done when people didn't think it could be done without being tongue-in-cheek and kind of being cheesy. I mean, they took this. And they made it really relevant and really serious and really, like they said, dire and dour and filled with gravitas. And people bought it. It had a huge fan base. It was critically received like nothing else. The New York Times called it the best show on television. And you know, that was lightning in a bottle. They actually pulled it off. But to try and pull it off again, I don't know if it can be done. They'd have to get a really good script.
That's not going to happen.
That's not going
to
happen.
But anyways, I just wanted to say in regards to the impression, the first impressions is how can this be a good series when they relaunched it. Point of fact is a colleague of mine at work had the same attitude. And then I lent him season one and he's hooked.
Yeah, see, I'm sure a lot of folks do. You know, they remember the Battlestar Galactica from the 70s with Lauren Green and Richard Hatch and Dirk Benedict and, you know, just strange. A strange mix of players going on there. We got a couple of stories we have this week are related to that. We've got a story coming up about Christopher McQuarrie, who's a longtime collaborator with Bryan Singer in many film projects, including The Usual Suspects and Valkyrie. If they can bring him on board, that would be great. But he's busy with something else, which we'll talk about in a second. But one of the things I did want to bring up, we mentioned Superman and Bryan Singer's remake. Well, it looks like Warner Brothers has got a little more to deal with before they do another Superman film, which They're considering another relaunch and another reimagining. And unfortunately, did we mention that Brandon Routh has been released from his contract?
This is the conclusion of a couple of stories.
Week, Warner Brothers has completely lost Krypton. Last year, a federal judge decided that Time Warner was no longer the sole proprietor of Superman, and that the heirs of the Jerry Siegel of Siegel and Schuster fame, who created Superman, they're entitled to a share of the U.S. copyright to the character. This week, a court ruled again, giving the Siegel family a larger share of that intellectual copyright. And in their race is on to get a new Superman film in flight by 2011, as Warner Brothers and DC Comics are set to lose the complete rights to the Man of Steel by 2013. That's a big deal. DC Comics is owned by Warner Brothers. Warner Brothers have the film rights. DC, of course, the comic book rights. And I believe it was, correct me if I'm wrong, the ruling was originally that the Siegel family were entitled to DC Comics profits based on the character, but not film profits.
Sounds about
until 2011, when those rights were also released, the film rights.
Exactly.
And they weren't entitled to that. So now it looks like that's really going to be a big deal, because they're going to get a larger piece. And they lose the rights completely in 2013. Of course, Superman first appeared in Action Comics number 1 in 1938, and Siegel and Schuster co-created the character. DC Comics owns everything after they sold the character and it's all of its rights to DC, and it's been deemed a work-for-hire relationship, basically. The court awarded the Siegel family with many aspects of the Superman copyright, including the basis of the Superman character, his costume, his alter ego, reporter Clark Kent, Lois Lane, the Daily Planet newspaper, and the Clark Superman and Lois love triangle storyline will all go back to the Siegel family.
Here's some trivia for you. Did you know that Joel Schuster was from Toronto? He was a Canadian.
I did.
And that Superman is, at least his progenitors were half Canadian, and that the Daily Planet newspaper is modeled after the
Star.
Toronto Star.
Oh, wow.
There you go.
I watched those heritage moments.
Nobody wants to see a really...
And sacrilege moments.
Yeah, we get that all the time here in Canada on television, the little heritage moments where they show... I think it might even... That the lady in the PSA might even be the basis for Lois Lane, or at least they want to make it look that way. But they show Joel... Is it Schuster?
It was Joel Schuster going off
with
to
a
New
sketch
York,
or whatever, going off to New Superman. York to meet up with his... cousin or whatever it is.
Or no, he was coming to Toronto from New York to meet up with his cousin.
Part of the Wayne and Schuster family.
Exactly. Oh, yeah. This concerns me greatly, because nobody wants to see a new Superman film more than me. I mean, they managed to relaunch Batman quite nicely. They're doing Green Lantern. And
they're doing the Green Hornet.
Green Hornet, of course. And Marvel's, you know, got a great take on all their superheroes with a few missteps. And... you know, Superman is the superhero of superheroes. And since the last reboot, the one with Bryan Singer, although it did very well in the box office, wasn't what people wanted, what wasn't people expected. They called it Superman Returns, and the joke is they should have called it Superman Lifts, because all he did was lift stuff. He didn't punch anybody. He punched somebody off camera. Didn't fight any crime. You know, didn't really do anything that super.
Bullet in his eye. That he squished.
Yeah, and they added that at the last minute. That was the final scene. They produced the bank robbery scene. But, you know, overall, the portrayal by Brandon Routh I thought was fantastic. Costume looked kind of cool. But not what people wanted. People wanted an action movie. And now with all this legal wrangling, I think that might put these things on the back burner. To continue along with this theme, we've got a great story about what Christopher McQuarrie's up to. He's the... like we mentioned before, the collaborator with Bryan Singer on many film projects.
And McQuarrie has signed on to write the script for Fox's Wolverine sequel. Hugh Jackman is set to return, as we already know, as Wolverine for a fifth time. Jackman is also producing this movie via his Fox-based Seed Shingle, along with Lauren Shuler Donner, the daughter of Richard Donner? or Wife?
I believe Wife. Yes, Wife.
The movie's storyline will take its cue from the early 1980s Chris Claremont slash Frank Miller miniseries, which was set in Japan and features Wolverine dealing with ninjas as he struggles whether to allow his animal killer instincts or the life under a samurai's code of honor.
It's a pretty damn cool storyline. I've got the graphic novel. It's pretty cool.
The storyline was hinted at in one of the movie's Easter egg endings. Of course, the other one was being, if you didn't see X-Men Wolverine, if you saw it and you didn't sit through the credits, there were two Easter egg endings. There was one that was featuring Deadpool, hinting on the Deadpool spinoff, which is coming underway. And then this one, as we were just saying, where Wolverine is in Japan, which is the story that Hugh Jackman originally wanted to do for this one, but felt he needed to go about it the way they did it with this one. The studio put a sequel in development after X-Men Origins Wolverine, carved up almost $180 million in domestic box office and $363 million worldwide. McQuarrie is not unfamiliar with the character. The scribe, who won an Oscar for writing The Usual Suspects for Bryan Singer, reteamed with the director for X-Men in 2000. Though McQuarrie could have received a credit, he voluntarily took his name off the movie when the final version was more in line with David Hayter's script than his.
I think this is probably very, very good news, considering the quality of the X-Men Origins Wolverine certainly wasn't what people, I think, were looking for, even though it did great, you know, box office at the beginning of the summer. Everybody involved probably recognized in retrospect that they could have ramped it up a bit better, and where do you start with that but with the writing? If it ain't on the page, it ain't on the stage, right?
It's funny, I was thinking about this recently. When a movie is really good, people credit the director. When it's really bad, they credit the writer.
They blame
the writer.
Yes and
say.
No. I mean, yeah, well, I got two words for you. Joel Schumacher. When Batman, the last Batman franchise before the current one went south, nobody was really blaming the writers, although the script was god-awful. They were blaming Joel Schumacher because he was kind of responsible for the look of the film. But they should have blamed the producers. They're just as much responsible for a look of a film as anybody else. This is something that Molly and I were actually talking about the other day. You know, I was kind of just very basically explaining what the roles of the writer, the director, and the producers are in a film production. And the producers, are, you know, of course, they get credit when, say, a film wins Best Picture at the Oscars, that sort of thing. But directors seem to be in the forefront. They get the credit when a commercial runs on TV, directed by so-and-so, whatever. They're really only, in many cases, hired by the producers to shoot the film, and they're only shooting the principal photography for the most part. The stuff that the characters are in, they're not really that responsible for many of the other elements of the film. That's all the producer, second unit, that sort of thing.
Unless you're Christopher Nolan.
Unless, well, in that regard, though, he's co-producing, he's co-writing.
Yeah.
That's where a lot of the larger, more successful directors get involved, people like your Spielbergs and Scorseses of the world.
Well, what they say about writers is that they're the least influential people on a movie, and that many directors don't want the writer anywhere near the set when they're filming.
Oh, you're banned.
Yeah.
You're banned from the set because the writer often has their own opinion. And my teacher, sorry to cut you off, she was telling me was she's been banned from many things that she's written because she's like, that's not what I wanted. So anyways, writers keep your mouth shut.
Can you imagine a writer giving a line reading in the middle of a shoot?
I mean,
there's also a story about the starlet, the would-be starlet, who was so stupid that she slept with the writer.
All right, next we've got a story about how major movie theater chain Cineplex Galaxy is doing this year. Apparently, they're doing very, very well.
That's right. Leak this to Jerry Schwartz at Onyx. I guess he's crying in his Canadian beer that he sold his Galaxy Cineplex shares because Cineplex's profit has tripled in its second quarter. Cineplex Galaxy Income Fund Chief Executive Ellis Jacob says more Canadians went to the movies during the second quarter, pushing revenues to record levels, more than tripling the profits. Now, the second quarter is April, May, and June of this year, and that's when we saw such movies as Star Trek, Wolverine, Terminator, Up, Angels and Demons, and Hangover. So that was a the reason for the success that Cineplex is experiencing as Canada's major exhibitor. Jacob said during a conference call that Cineplex attributes this growth to the wide and varied appeal of the movies on screen, starting with Fast and Furious and Monsters vs. Aliens, which performed very well in April, a month that historically has not featured strong releases. Now, as Jamie pointed out, we're seeing that the summer blockbuster movies are starting earlier and earlier every year. So this is an example of that effect it's having on the marketplace. In May, every weekend saw the release of a major blockbuster, which included four of the top five performing films during the quarter. Now, the Toronto-based fund posted net income of $19.9 million for the quarter ended June 30th. That's more than three times higher than the year earlier profits of only $6 million. Now, the earnings were equivalent to 62.8 cents distributable cash per unit. That's nearly 56% higher than the 40.3 cents per unit only a year ago. Cineplex booked $248.6 million of revenue, the highest since the fund's inception, and an increase from $209.3 million only a year ago. The results were also helped by a variety of premium-priced events, including 3D movies like Coraline and IMAX screenings of Star Trek. Now, how more expensive are they than regular admission? About $2 or $3 more?
About $3 more, yeah.
So they can attribute that to the profits as well. And attendance revenue has jumped 16.2% to $18.2 million. So as we've talked about it before, the recession is having an effect because the movies, comparatively speaking to sports such as hockey, remain a cheap night out. Now, the higher number of patrons also helped concession revenues, which rose nearly 20% to $74.2 million from $62 million. Now, that's a lot of popcorn. Jacob said in the last 12 months that Cineplex hasn't raised its prices at the concession stands because its focus is to attract as many people to its theaters, and they remain extremely cautious about pricing. That said, I mean, it's still, when you consider popcorn, how cheap it is for the kernels and the markup that they have on such things as popcorn and pop and the rest of it. And a reasonably sized pop and popcorn costs you close to $10. So they should remain cautious on their pricing before people start sneaking in cans of cola and the result. The fund also declared cash distributions of 31.5 cents per unit, and that is an increase of 0.5 cents per unit paid out in the same quarter last year. Now, it's interesting to also note that this year's second quarter even surpassed last year's third quarter, and those are the summer months of July, August, and September, which are the hottest blockbuster months of the year. So that's quite an achievement and quite an interesting bit of news from the exhibitors' side of things in the movie industry.
Well, it's definitely great news for theatergoers and particularly the Canadian economy for us here. This is the Canadian profits that we were talking about there, which is fine, and it just goes to prove that we've known since. Pretty much March, that this has already been on pace for a record box office year in North America. January alone was a $1 billion North American month at the box office. January. One of the worst months of the year to go see a movie. But also it's important to note that, yes, it's the recession, which is now an economic downturn, making movies go the cheaper form of entertainment as opposed to the way they were 3 years ago when everybody was complaining about a $12 movie ticket. So it's just going to prove that we are right, that movies are enjoyable once again. From April until July, there was a new number one movie every weekend at the box office until Harry Potter repeated 2 weeks in a row. And so it's just going on. The box office numbers are incredibly high for this year, and it's going to be another record year, which will break last year's record, which broke 2007's record box office year.
It'd be interesting. I've always wondered, in terms of economies of scale, that if a major exhibitor like Cineplex were to cut their admission prices or cut some of their concession prices, how much more they would actually sell, that it would, you know, increase sales, and that they might earn even more money by giving the public a break during the recession.
Economic downturn. The recession's over.
Yeah.
Didn't you get the memo? Obama said so. Sorry.
Well, definitely an interesting story coming out of Cineplex. Not terribly surprising, although, you know, prices have stabilized. I don't think they've gone up since last year, have they?
I haven't noticed.
Yeah, I haven't noticed. And, you know, there are different ways that the various theater chains have been offering discounts on box office and concessions with different cards and that sort of thing. So it's been pretty good, I think, overall.
I think also interest in movies is starting to peak because you're having more free screenings, such as Harbourfront in Toronto and Yonge Dundas Square, of recent first-run movies. I know that, help me, guys, best picture winner, Slumdog Millionaire, right, is being screened publicly. And that's, you know, less than a year than it's been up for free that you can see it. And it's like going to the drive-in without your car. And I think that this would create the habit of going to movies with people who might have fallen out of the habit.
Well, yeah, but I think the issue there, of course, is the age-old issue of, you make quality content and people will go to the theaters. Right. And these days it tends to be a lot of films, especially during the summer, that appeal to 18 to 29-year-olds, male and female, or even younger.
It's interesting this year, as we've said, is this is the summer of the writer's strike, and it was predicted that it was going to be a bad summer this year because so many movies were put on hold or rushed to production before the writer's strike because, you know, there's about a 14 to 16-month window from when a movie starts shooting to when it's actually released. At the time of the writer's strike, all these movies that Angels and Demons and Star Trek and Harry Potter were either stopped in production or pushed off, or they were rushed into production, like Transformers and Terminator Salvation. So it was making for looking like a bad summer, but it's turning out to be a not so bad summer after all.
Well, the point that Jamie made about the movies attracting 18 to 29 years old who have that disposable income, you look at a movie that comes out like Julie and Julia, which just came out 2 weeks ago, and that's attracting older audiences that have sort of given up on going to movie theaters, and you know, they, like everybody else, still like Saturday night as a date out. And it's interesting because when you saw, for example, Titanic come out again, it expanded the demographic of movie attendance. And I think that this is something that Hollywood should take a look at. As the population is aging, there are a lot of people who are not being served by the slam bang blow 'em up movies. And when you come across a Julie and Julia, the results are the profits are there for the taking.
All right, so let's move on to some news regarding one of the most popular and critically acclaimed reality shows, if that's an oxymoron. I don't know what is, but Big Brother on CBS has encountered some more controversy. Contestant Chyma Simone was kicked out of the Big Brother house by producers this past weekend for rules violations. Bloggers watching live feeds on the internet reported she threw her microphone into the backyard pool and refused to put on a new one. Her departure apparently occurred very early Saturday morning. According to CBS, they released a statement that said Chyma has been evicted by the producers from the Big Brother house for violating the rules. She will not be part of the show's jury. Her eviction will be addressed on an upcoming broadcast of the show. Simone, a freelance journalist, has just apparently endured two key setbacks. Now, her head of household nominations, of course, were overturned Thursday by fellow contestant Jeff Schroeder via a rare coup d'etat power granted him by the viewers. On Friday, she was nominated for eviction alongside house ally Natalie Martinez. Simone had earlier in the week threatened to disrupt the series' August 13th telecast if her nominees were removed that day, as they ultimately were. It's widely assumed her threats precipitated CBS's decision to pre-tape that evening's telecast rather than, as per tradition, air it live. There's no word yet on whether the current head of household, neuroscientist Michelle Noonan, has nominated or will nominate for eviction another house guest, or whether sequestered ex-house guest Jesse Godderes might rejoin the house as replacement. Next Thursday's live edition was expected to be the series' annual double eviction episode, which traditionally tosses two contestants out of the house within the span of an hour. And here's an update. Schroeder's ally, Jordan Lloyd, became the new head of household in a surprise competition held on Saturday, so I'm guessing plans for a Thursday double eviction have been scrapped, and Godderes will not be returning to the competition. Simone is not the first Big Brother house guest to be ejected by producers. New Jersey bartender Justin Sebeck was expelled from Big Brother 2 when, on July 11th in 2001, he held a knife to the throat of fellow house guest Krista Stigall and asked, "Would you get mad if I killed you?" Sebeck is also sharing kisses with Stigall at the time. The video, I believe, is available on YouTube. Later, after it was discovered that Sebeck had been twice arrested for assault in 1996 and 1997, Stigall sued CBS for failing to conduct a thorough enough background check. Thursday's edition of Big Brother was TV's highest-rated broadcast that night, with adults 18 to 34 years old, beating shows like 30 Rock, The Office, and CSI. We've got one more story regarding what Jay Leno is going to do with his new 10 p.m. I won't call it late night, but prime time, I guess it will be, talk show that he's going to be producing and starring in Monday to Friday beginning this fall. Aaron, why don't you fill us in on what's going to be happening for the first guest on NBC's The Jay Leno Show.
I feel like we should get a drum roll.
Yada, yada, yada.
Well, I do know, we didn't report on this, but I'll add another thing. I know who the musical guest is going to be as well.
Okay. Well, let's get the musical guest first.
The musical guest is going to be none other than Rihanna in her first appearance since her unfortunate encounter with her boyfriend Chris Brown before the, what was it, Emmys, Oscars? I don't know. But, you know.
Grammys, a couple months back.
Yeah,
yes.
Some months back.
All right. More importantly, the first guest on the Jay Leno Show is going to be none other than, I already did the drum roll, Jerry Seinfeld. And so this is kind of a, it's a big deal in that it's the Jay Leno's first guest on his first primetime show, the show that is killing off NBC for this fall. But also in the fact that in late night, there's been such a shift because Jay Leno left the Tonight Show and Conan O'Brien took over for the Tonight Show and Jimmy Fallon took over for Conan O'Brien. Conan O'Brien's first guest on the Tonight Show as host was Will Ferrell. And when Jimmy Fallon took over Conan O'Brien's show, he had Robert De Niro. So big name actors as the first guest of a new show have been the trend in late night this year. No word yet is on whether Seinfeld will also be the first celebrity to participate in Leno's product placement celebrity car races. In a press release from Jay Leno's website?
No, that's from NBC.
Sorry, and NBC's press release reads, Seinfeld will join previously announced musical guests Jay-Z, Kanye West, and Rihanna. The Jay Leno Show will premiere on Monday, September 14th. Jay Leno welcomes friend and fellow comedian Jerry Seinfeld to kick off his primetime comedy series, The Jay Leno Show, which will air Monday to Fridays from 10 to 11. Leno moved from late night to primetime in his new comedy show premiering Monday, September 14th. The Jay Leno Show will be the first entertainment program to be stripped across primetime on broadcast network television and will showcase many of the features that have made Leno America's late night leader for more than a dozen years. The Jay Leno Show is from Big Dog Productions in association with Universal Media Studios. Debbie Vickers is the executive producer.
So I'm very curious to see how the show is going to be received. It's a 10 o'clock show. They're completely eliminating that hour-long block where they've often had drama such as ER.
ER.
And it's interesting because that block of time, I think, has been it's been an unspoken almost rule that block of time can't have comedy. It's got to have drama. It's got to have something like that. And I think the cable networks, such as Comedy Central and so forth, have been programming all kinds of different things in the 10 o'clock slot to great success. And so I think that the major networks, CBS, ABC, NBC, and Fox, have realized that you don't have to have a drama in that spot. And in fact, you don't even have to have a scripted show in that spot. And it's interesting that, you know, Jay Leno retires from The Tonight Show, but then he just goes back in and does another show that my prediction will be probably isn't that different from The Tonight Show, or at least what he was doing with The Tonight Show.
Well, Craig Ferguson, he has the Late Night Show.
The Late Late Show.
The Late Late Show. Now we've got the Early Late Show.
Yeah, is it too much? There are too many choices? There's really no competition with Jay Leno except for, like I said, those other programs that are airing on different cable networks, whether it's South Park or The Simpsons or whatever. So it's going to be new programming, obviously. So there's an advantage there.
It's also NBC is trying to work up the ranks. For the last few years, it's been fourth in the top in the networks in the rankings. It's having a lot of internal struggles.
Ben Silverman leaving.
Shows that have flopped. It's been just drama and turmoil in NBC in the recent years. So they needed to save money, and late shows are a lot cheaper than scripted television, and that's basically the whole point behind the idea that they had with doing a late night primetime show.
So that wraps up our stories for this week. Aaron, you had something that you wanted to talk about before we wrap up this week's show.
Yeah, I just wanted to direct, because I'm plugging my poll that I have on the blog right now, favorite franchise of the decade, because as we alluded to on the last episode of Inside Movies and TV, at the end of the year is the end of the decade. So not only are there going to be end of year shows, there's going to be end of decade best of shows. And I want us to do the same thing, and I want to make it user-friendly. So I have right now an interactive poll online where you can go to the blog, moviesandtvcast.blogspot.com, and you can choose between, I think I have 7 franchises out there, they're on there. They're Bourne, Harry Potter, Lord of the Rings, Spider-Man, X-Men, and Pirates of the Caribbean and Oceans. Did I say Pirates already? I might have said that twice. Anyways, so what I wanted to throw at your guys' way is we were talking a little bit about this a couple weeks ago, Jamie, is Lord of the Rings.
Right.
When you're going to think back to this decade, is Lord of the Rings the franchise that defines the decade? Not necessarily your favorite one, but the best movie franchise of the decade. It's when you think back, it's going to be, oh, what do you remember about the 2000s? First thing off your mind will probably be Lord of the Rings or Michael Jackson.
I think it's the best, but I think the franchise that has the through line throughout the entire decade has to be the Harry Potter franchise, simply because it almost runs from beginning to end.
Right.
There have been more movies, more releases, more of course, hype and excitement. Not only that, but not to downplay what Peter Jackson pulled off, because what he did do was a near miracle. You know, he took these Tolkien books and brought them to a big screen, and they were absolutely fantastic, award winning, and nobody could have imagined that these would have been as good as they are. However, you take a look at the Harry Potter movies; every single one of them was a box office smash. Every single one of them had critical acclaim. They cast the principal characters; these actors were very, very young, and they've developed into great actors. And who would have thought that every single one practically has, has really done well and has really got some acting chops. And overall, the quality keeps getting better. Each one has its own tone and feel. But they've been incredibly successful. Say what you want about them. I think the Harry Potter franchise is probably the franchise of the decade.
Very good. Dennis, I was throwing that your way.
I think I agree with Jamie. Harry Potter really... a whole generation is growing up with him. It's interesting because that's what Disney does when they take their films away, send them back to the vaults, and they bring them out when a whole bunch of new kiddies are born, and they get to come out and get freaked out by Bambi's mother's death one more time. I think that's going to happen with Harry Potter, is that they're going to be re-released for new generations as well. It'll be like Disney. I can't see that obviously happening with Lord of the Rings or any other franchise that really comes to mind. But Harry Potter is a real industry. I'm waiting for the 3D animated version. I'm waiting for the Broadway musical.
Broadway.
I'm waiting for the men of the line of men's golf shirts. You know, it's really an asset that hasn't been exploited and explored fully yet. So I would think that that would get my vote as probably the top. I mean, there's the James Bond franchise that keeps going, too. You know,
but of the decade.
That started in the decade, you mean?
Yeah.
Okay.
So to kind of just enlighten my criteria that I quickly made up was the first movie had to come out in 2000.
Okay.
And it had to have, or after. Sorry, yeah. Within 2000, as early as 2000, there had to be at least three movies, because if not, you have a movie and a sequel. So I omitted Batman Begins and The Dark Knight, and I omitted Chronicles of Narnia, because there's only two movies like that.
What about Spider-Man? Did you mention
that? Spider-Man is in there, yes. Yeah. Yes. And so far it doesn't have any votes.
No, the third one.
just ruined it.
But I think that Harry Potter also is a runner, is a contender, I should say, because it appeals to such, again, a wide demographic. Is you have grandparents taking their grandchildren.
Right.
And it,
right.
Again, all age groups. And you think of the other franchises, I can't think of another one that does that as well. Maybe Lord of the Rings, I don't know, but that's a different kind of crowd.
Well, I was just kind of mentioning it because Lord of the Rings, I think, and I have the utmost respect for Harry Potter, and I actually never thought about it in the way you guys just explained. Lord of the Rings, it redefined the science fiction fantasy genre. Mm-hmm. And those three movies were just so well done together, three of them back-to-back, recorded back-to-back-to-back-to-back. That's only that, and it's with the cinematography and everything, and you know, say what you want. I think you have to look at the franchise. You can pick out your favorite movie, which for most people is The Two Towers, which is the second one. But if you look at the franchise as a whole, this is one thing that I was mentioning to Jamie. You know, the whole franchise, all three movies, is three acts. There's the first act, second act, the third act, but. Back to the cinematography, the way it was shot, the fight scenes, everything has only ever been imitated. They came out with Kingdom of Heaven and Troy and Chronicles of Narnia. Everybody took what Lord of the Rings, what was done with Lord of the Rings, and tried to expand on it, making and often imitated it, exceeded it. And for reasons like that, I think that might be my best franchise of the decade.
What is the top earning franchise of the ones we've mentioned that are in the running?
The top earning one is Harry Potter.
Just for sheer volume of movies, though.
Yeah,
there are simply more movies.
Yes.
Top earning franchise of all time, of course, is the Star Wars.
No,
nope,
it's Harry Potter now.
Oh, it's Harry Potter. Harry Potter beat the Star Wars one. Okay, even worse.
Top earning film is still Titanic.
Top earning film is still Titanic. I'll do you one better, though, Aaron. I know you mentioned Troy and Kingdom of Heaven. I believe probably...
I love those movies, by the way.
In my opinion, though, I think those were offshoots of the success of Gladiator. It takes time to get those spun up, and I think they were looking for lots of what they called sword and sandal epics. You used to call them back in the days of Lawrence of Arabia and Spartacus. I think those are probably offshoots of that. I don't think you can... I mean, I think if there's one franchise that's kind of a spinoff of Lord of the Rings, it would be the Chronicles of Narnia franchise, where they've taken another iconic set of books and tried to make a movie franchise out of it.
I think Gladiator released in 2000?
Yes, it was.
I think it was, it had the line of the decade. At my signal, unleash hell.
Yeah.
I was going to say, this is Sparta, but that's 300.
So, you know what, it's very interesting. One thing I did note right away, and that is that the Matrix franchise is in there, because the first Matrix film came out in 1998 or 1999. Same year that Star Wars: Phantom Menace came out. So that kind of exempts it. But even still, even if it was included in there, I don't think it would. It would be a front runner, but not, you know. I mean, the quality of the last two films was high, but the story was a little, you know, bogged down, I think. A lot of people have their problems with the Matrix trilogy. You know, another franchise where it had a, you know, a massive first movie and then Not so much after that.
Okay, so what's your favorite franchise or of the decade, or the best franchise of the decade? Let us know. You can send us an email at moviesandtvcast@gmail.com. Go and take part on the online poll at moviesandtvcast.blogspot.com. We will use the results in a future episode of the show, fingers crossed, and expect more decade-themed polls on the blog. I'm hoping to put more, but I also want some feedback.
I'm trying
to do a TV one as well. Commercials? No. Can't do commercials. What would your favorite commercial? We'll talk about that enough.
I think coming up in October, we should probably do favorite horror movie of the past 10 years.
Yes.
The nominees for that one. Favorite holiday movie coming up, I'm sure. And the list will go on, I'm sure. We'll come up with lots of great ones. All right, so that should wrap things up for show number 66 of Inside Movies and TV. We are taking a bit of a hiatus next week. There will be no show next week as I am taking a little vacation, and we'll be out of town at the time. But we'll have one final show of the summer towards the end of the month, and we'll wrap up what we thought of the summer movie season and what we can look forward to coming into the fall, where a lot of people like to call it award season, as well as maybe some light coverage of what's going to happen at the Toronto International Film Festival. So please, again, feel free to send in your comments to moviesandtvcast@gmail.com. Check out the blog, of course, moviesandtvcast.blogspot.com. Check us out on iTunes and our own website at imtv.podomatic.com. Special thanks to Scott Johnson, Scott Fletcher, Dennis Kucharawi. Thank you for joining us again, Dennis. And, of course, Aaron Shaw for maintaining and moderating our fantastic blog with all the latest movie and television news and info. And
a DVD review.
And DVD,
I was asked to do a DVD review.
Yes. New DVD review for the latest Just for Laughs DVD from the Just for Laughs Comedy Festival in Montreal. From what it sounds, it's a pretty good program. Let the crowd-